The leader of ISIS is dead. Online in jihadi chat rooms, his followers are vowing revenge.
We're already seeing a wave of messages calling for incitement, calling for attacks, calling for sacrifices and suicide operations.
And as wildfires rage in California, Australians battle their own.
People need to understand that if you live on or even near the bush, that there is an element of risk that comes with that.
And Congo music from Belize, it's part funkadelic, part KC and the Sunshine Band.
When you listen to the music, you will dance to the Congo music sound.
The Belizean innovation known as Congo. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. You've heard the news. After a five-year manhunt, U.S. commandos killed the world's most wanted man, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of the Islamic State, or ISIS. When Osama bin Laden was killed by American special forces, his body was quickly buried at sea. This afternoon, General Mark Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was asked what happened to the ISIS leader's remains.
Baghdadi was his remains were disposed of appropriately in accordance with our SOPs and in accordance with the law of armed conflict.
SOPs, that's standard operating procedures. Milley also said that the special forces captured two men at the compound and that both are now in U.S. custody. Milley was also asked if the location in Syria where Baghdadi died was his headquarters and how much intelligence material was gathered at the site by U.S. forces.
There was material taken away. I don't want to characterize exactly what or how much yet until it gets exploited properly. But as a matter of course, we always do sensitive site exploitation on any objective anywhere to do that. As to whether it's his headquarters, it was an area in which he was staying on a consistent basis.
U.S. intelligence officers will now be analyzing the information they recovered. But what is ISIS saying about the death of its leader? With more on that, here's The World's Shirin Jafari.
Saturday night, as U.S. forces raided Baghdadi's compound in northwest Syria, local social media accounts lit up.
It seemed to be different from the usual airstrikes the U.S. conducts. I mean, it was involving helicopters, much more extensive use of force. So clearly there was some very high-value target who was being hunted down.
Ayman Al-Tamimi is an expert on the Islamic State based in the U.K. He says these days, ISIS supporters are mostly active on a smartphone app called Telegram. And in the hours that followed the U.S. raid in Syria, pro-ISIS Telegram channels dismissed the idea that Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi had been killed. They had heard these reports before. In the past, Baghdadi's death was falsely reported in Iranian, Syrian, Iraqi, and Russian media outlets. So this time, ISIS supporters seemed to be waiting it out. Aaron Zillin is with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. In the hours that followed the raid, Zillin was following ISIS chatter online closely.
Much of it's just sort of small messages being like, we shouldn't believe the, you know, Kufar media or infidel media. They're always lying and there's disinformation.
Last night, the United States brought the world's number one terrorist leader to justice.
After Trump made that announcement on Sunday morning, Zillin noticed a shift in messages from ISIS.
I think that they started to internalize things more and then shifted the message more to honoring Baghdadi as the caliph, resurrecting the caliphate, as well as the fact that, you know, this movement will continue to go on whether he is alive or dead, because this isn't a movement of leaders, this is a movement of ideas and a broader project.
So far, there has been no official statement about Baghdadi's death on the group's official media channels. Zillin says the group's leaders will want to verify Baghdadi's death independently, and he says they will want to come up with the right messaging.
One of the things to remember about ISIS is the fact that, you know, the whole media messaging propaganda game is so important for them. They see it as just as important as the fighting on the ground.
Mansour Al-Haj is a researcher with the Middle East Media Research Institute. Since news broke of Baghdadi's death, he has noticed that some ISIS supporters have been renewing their allegiance to the group online.
It's a statement, it's like a one-paragraph statement that has been circulating since the emergence of ISIS.
But Mansour says rival extremist groups like Al-Qaeda also seem to be taking advantage of this moment.
Some of Al-Qaeda supporters are saying, well, now Baghdadi has done a lot of damage to jihad movement around the world and has sown like discord between jihadi groups. So they are calling on ISIS fighters now to join Al-Qaeda.
Ayman Al-Tamimi, the researcher, says he's keeping a close eye on the official ISIS channels to see how they handle the news of Baghdadi's death.
Do they announce it as a simple news item that they put out? Or are they going to put it in their newsletter, in the bi-weekly newsletter? It's like being glued constantly to the IS national news channels and waiting, when will the announcement come out?
Experts say it's not unusual for extremist groups to take a few days to confirm the death of their leaders. Al-Qaeda took 4 days to announce the death of Osama bin Laden in 2011. It might take ISIS even longer, given that the group has lost most of its territory, thousands of its fighters, and now its founder and leader. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
For more on this, we reached out to Rita Katz, who directs the Site Intelligence Group. Site is an organization that tracks and analyzes the online activity of extremist communities around the world. Katz says she's seeing lots of talk in online jihadi chat rooms calling for retaliation for Baghdadi's death.
We're already seeing a wave of messages calling for attacks, calling for sacrifices and suicide operations, despite the fact that they still don't believe the news. But if Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi did enlighten his suicide vest and carried out a suicide operation, they should all do the same. I think what we will be seeing in the near future and even after that is a wave of incitement against the West. Mainly will be focused, at least at the beginning, on American targets, not only in the U.S., but any American targets, interests around the world.
I was going to ask you about that, because sometimes the reaction can be very specific. Are there details being sent out to followers about how to actually stage reprisal attacks?
Yes, absolutely. ISIS has already prepared manuals and instructions and articles on how to carry out these attacks. So right now is the perfect time for them to circulate all these publications that they're already ready to go in various languages. And that's what we are seeing also, along with pictures of targets and incitements for specific targets, especially in the United States.
Rita, what sort of talk are you hearing online and elsewhere about a successor to Baghdadi?
As of now, ISIS did not issue anything, not a confirmation, and obviously not a replacement. However, important to mention that when it comes to the online military claims and operation, ISIS is currently operating as nothing happened. Claims for attacks in Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, and other locations continue to come as usual. I believe that we will see a statement in the next few days. Not sure if that specific statement will also provide already the name of the successor. I believe that the successor was already nominated by the group, who has to be somebody from the descent of the Prophet Muhammad, if they want to continue claiming the caliphate.
So U.S. officials say the mission targeting Baghdadi started in its planning stages about 5 months ago. That's about the time when Baghdadi's last video was published, his first in 5 years. Do you think that's relevant, Rita?
I believe that it's not a coincidence. We have seen events in the past that a video released by a head of the group that has not been seen for years would actually instigate the opening, providing new information for an ongoing investigation. Look, I don't know if you remember when Zarqawi, Abu Masab al-Zarqawi, was killed. He was the head of basically ISIS before it became the Islamic State. He was killed a month after he appeared in a video for the first time, not disguised. And so based on that information, the U.S. government was able to reach and find his location and kill him. It sounds pretty interesting that 5 months ago the investigation started, and which is 5 months ago was the first time that we got to see Baghdadi in a new video released in April after not seeing him in any video for 5 years since the announcement and since his famous Khutbah Friday sermon at the mosque in Mosul.
Do you think there was some metadata in that video that helped this mission?
I believe that that video was analyzed in a way that we can't even understand the type of technology that can be put into it. But absolutely, I'm sure that American intelligence and other intelligence had great interest in everything that they could find from that video.
Rita Katz with the Site Intelligence Group, thank you for being with us today and explaining this.
Thank you.
And now we've come to that point in the show where we turn our attention to good old Brexit. And when I say old, I'm talking 3.5 years since the vote happened. And now we're just 3 days away from the deadline for the UK to get out of Europe. For months, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has been treating Halloween as a hard and fast deadline.
I'd rather be dead in a ditch.
Come out of the EU on October the 31st. No ifs or buts.
We are coming out of the EU on October the 31st, come what may.
Well, today the EU said, what's 3 more months to sort things out? That's not what Johnson wanted, but he took the extension and blamed Parliament.
The electorate will, I'm afraid, have a sense that we're all like Charlie Brown, endlessly running up to kick the ball, only to have Parliament take it away, whisk that ball away yet again.
Johnson called for a general election on December 12th. He's gambling that a new Parliament will give him the majority he needs to push through his version of Brexit. But this evening in London, Parliament said no to Johnson's idea, and so the future of Brexit remains uncertain yet again. But there is one thing we do know. The British House of Commons will be a less colorful place after Thursday when this man surrenders the gavel.
Order! The rights of my order!
Speaker of Parliament John Bercow, he of the booming chastising calls to order, order. Bercow steps down as Speaker on Thursday, depriving Parliament watchers of moments like this.
However irritating the Honourable Gentleman... to government backbenchers, he has a right to be heard.
Yeah, we'll miss that. The next Speaker of Parliament will be chosen on Monday. Last month, we told you the story of an elderly woman in northern France. For years, she had a religious painting hanging over the hot plate in her kitchen, a roughly 8x10-inch painting of a Christ-like figure surrounded by a jeering crowd. The woman did not think the weathered and cracked piece was worth much. She was about to junk it until an auctioneer advised her to have it evaluated first. Wise move. Turns out it was an 800-year-old long-lost masterpiece by the Florentine artist Cimabue. Only about 10 of his known works still exist. It was valued at, wait for it, $6.5 million. This weekend it sold for 4 times that. An anonymous buyer paid over $26 million. Dominique Lecon is the head at Aceton Auction House, where the painting was sold. He spoke through an interpreter.
It was a sale of all possibilities. Cimabue is a great painter and it's a unique work of art. There are no others like it. Anyone who wanted a Cimabue painting today was ready for anything. Obviously, we knew that our estimate had some potential. Already at 10 to 12 million euros, we were immensely happy. But to finish at more than 24 million euros is more than we could have dreamed of.
The auction house says the sale marks a new world record for a medieval painting sold at auction. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Hong Kong is in recession. After nearly 5 months of street protests, the economy in one of China's most important business hubs is slowing down. Retail sales are plunging. Also, tourism is off 50% in October compared with last year. And the U.S.-China trade war is taking a financial toll. The demonstrations in Hong Kong have been led mostly by young people, protesting the way China governs the territory. It's easy to make a historical comparison to 1989, when young people in Beijing's Tiananmen Square also protested.
In Beijing, 30 years ago, we were begging for something called freedom that we never taste them. But once we were smashed, and we just gave up.
That's Han Dongfang. He was a protest leader in Tiananmen Square. After the bloody crackdown, he spent a couple of years in prison. He later fled to Hong Kong. Now he's a labor organizer based there. And he's watching and supporting this young generation of protesters. Han told me the movement in Hong Kong is different from Tiananmen in one crucial way.
today, the Hong Kong young people, what they are doing is not begging and asking for freedom, is they have been living in freedom, now someone attempting to take it away. So that is the fundamental difference. That is what I believe these people will never give up.
How much have you been speaking with protesters in Hong Kong in recent weeks, and what have you been hearing?
I am not really speaking to them. I am participating in every major protest. I am in the street. I observe them, and I learn from them. Because I will remember in 2014, I saw these young people break into the highway, and I run into them and I say, look, you get to get out from the highway. You are giving them excuses to shoot you. And I came from 1989 Tiananmen Square. That's what happened at that time. They get the excuse and they start shooting people. And people don't want to listen to me. And I feel kind of sad about they are really not taking their life carefully, and they are really taking great risk.
But Dongfeng, aren't the protesters today also giving the authorities plenty of reasons to kind of stage reprisals? I mean, subway stations have been set alight. They've occupied the airport. I mean, they're giving, it seems, the police a lot of reasons to crack down on them.
Yes, you can say today even more than 2014, even more than 30 years ago in Tiananmen Square, what the protesters are doing. But the fundamental difference is the protesters, the mentality and the courage. 30 years ago, we were fighting for something in our dream. We never know. We never taste it. If we don't get it, and we don't really lose anything. But nowadays, these people, what from my observation in the streets, every major protest, I can see the determination from their face, from their body language, and especially this is joined by men and women, young men and women, and women are not following a man, and women are on their own. Mm-hmm. So all over in street, they, in their face, in their body language, you can read, they are ready to burn together if it burns.
So Dongfeng, what is your advice to the Hong Kong protesters at this moment, and where should they steer that courage?
I'm afraid I don't have any strategic suggestion to them because I don't have it. I am busy learning from them about the creativity of organizing different activities and protests and every day during the week and evening and day. So this is very new to me.
So U.S. Vice President Mike Pence says America stands with Hong Kong, and he criticized China for curtailing the rights and liberties of Hong Kongers. Does that help the protesters, or does it just add to the Chinese government's claim that this whole protest movement is a Western-inspired separatist movement?
Well, it's definitely helped the movement, the protests in Hong Kong, and to make the Chinese government to think twice what to do. But I have very serious question here. As Mr. Pence or Mr. Trump, are they taking this position as a strategic move to make themselves in better position during the trade deal, trade talk, as a chip, or as they are taking it as principle that no matter what, even their if there's no trade war, they will take this human rights and democracy matter seriously. What about if the U.S.-China trade deal goes well? Will they pull back? There will be no pressure. There's no concern. And what the Hong Kong people will do with that?
So help us with this one, final question, Dongfeng. Despite some of the police crackdown and protesters disrupting business and mass transit in Hong Kong, it seems many Hong Kongers have not abandoned or given up on the protesters and their actions. Why do you think that is? What does it tell us?
You know, Hong Kong people have enjoyed the freedom. There's not much democracy in the past up to this point, but enjoy the freedom. Freedom means you don't have to realize that every day morning when you wake up, you say, I'm in freedom. No, freedom, the beauty of freedom, you don't realize that every day. You don't have to pay attention. But once someone attempt to take it, whether you're a business person, big business, small business, big like Mr. Li Ka-ching, small like the corner street, you open a small restaurant.
Li Ka-ching is a big tycoon in Hong Kong, right?
Yeah, big tycoon, one of the richest person in Asia and the world, maybe. These people, they all suddenly feel their freedom is maybe facing to a risk. And this is what make people bring people together. You lose the same things that you enjoy. You didn't really have to feel it every day. Now you feel the same danger. But the same, even the people who are walking in the street to protest for the same things, are fearful of losing freedom, and they're not necessarily all left or right in the middle or what they, but they are gathered together on this one same interests and fear, which is fearful of losing freedom. So that's my explanation about why Hong Kong people, even the business people, they lose some business. They're not happy, but they're still tolerate this because they know that ahead of them, there will be bigger things to lose.
Han Dongfang, a protest leader at Tiananmen Square in 1989 and currently a labor activist. Thank you very much for your perspective. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you. Nice talking to you.
You're listening to The World. Cargo ships crisscross the globe transporting our goods. The fossil fuel that powers it all brings a steep environmental cost. So some shippers are looking toward an ancient technology, sails.
The wind and the cost of wind is entirely predictable. It is always free.
But are the ocean winds enough to power the modern global economy? That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. Let's get back to our top story. U.S. commandos yesterday killed the leader of the Islamic State, or ISIS. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is dead. But what about ISIS itself? Senator Jack Reed is a Democrat from Rhode Island and the ranking member of the Senate Armed Services Committee. He says ISIS is far from done.
They will, I think, try to reconstitute their forces, try to conduct significant attacks, indicate that they're back. And one of the factors that might help them is that our withdrawal from Syria gives them more open space and could allow many of them to escape from their detention facilities and reconstitute a fighting force.
Senator Reid, how will all of this affect the daily operations of ISIS? I mean, what do they have the ability to do right now?
Well, they have been very resourceful and resilient. They have, because of the pressure we've put on them, learned to operate in discrete units. There are, again, I would think at this juncture, particularly trying to take advantage of any lapses in the Syrian Kurdish area, they're trying to reconstitute their units, keep them low profile, but also continue to plan for attacks against our forces and our allies.
So what should American officials be turning their attention to right now? What has to be done on the part of the U.S.?
We have to try to reconstruct the presence that we had in Syria under the control of the Kurds. That would mean trying to get our intelligence reestablished, and it's harder today than it was 2 weeks ago.
What does this death of the head of ISIS do to Trump's image? What are you hearing people saying on Capitol Hill?
Well, I think, again, the president had to make a very tough decision, and he made that decision, and it succeeded. But I think the other factors that he's brought upon, the hasty withdrawal from Syria, the situation with Iran, which is very tense and sensitive, regional problems all over. I think the situation will be continually complex and threatening in the region, and that'll bear on public perception of the president.
So you're saying not the full-throated victory that President Trump would like everybody to believe it is.
What these radical groups have shown over the last 16 or 17 years, that we can deal serious blows to their leadership, we can disrupt some of their operations, but they will continue to try. There are active plots every day that we have to root out. So to simply sort of declare victory and walk away would be completely inappropriate.
You are literally hearing about active plots every day?
You will hear about those types of situations that small cells are working. That's something that goes on. That's why our Homeland Security and our FBI and also our international forces are key. I think the one mistake we would make to think that a high-profile success means that thousands and thousands of these committed radical individuals would simply stop and go back to a peaceful pursuit.
That was Senator Jack Reed, a Democrat from Rhode Island and the ranking member of the Senate Armed Services Committee. He was speaking with us from Washington. Today, thousands of people in Los Angeles were ordered to evacuate after a fast-moving brush fire ignited near the Getty Center Museum. It was the latest outbreak in a wildfire season that has put the entire state of California on alert. We're thinking of you all on the West Coast today. We're also thinking of people 7,000 miles from you on the East Coast of Australia, where the news is remarkably similar.
Good evening. As we go to air tonight, 90 bushfires are burning across
the
state.
Huge plumes of smoke filled the sky as a fire at Darawang, north of Foster.
New South Wales Rural Fire Service has warned today could be one of the most dangerous for bushfires so far this season.
It's been an incredibly busy start to this fire season.
Inspector Ben Shepherd spoke with us today from the control center of the New South Wales Rural Fire Service.
And we've seen more fires burn more land in the past 3 months than we've actually seen over the last two fire seasons combined.
Shepherd says the Australian states of New South Wales and Queensland have sent thousands of firefighters to battle bushfires up and down Australia's east coast. Some areas have seen no rain for 2 years, conditions that have grown only more severe with climate change. And the dry heat of Australia's summer is just around the corner.
It will be a massive effort whilst we look down the barrel of what is going to be a potentially long and protracted fire season. I'd love nothing more than to see a heap of rain over the next week or two, but the Bureau of Meteorology is suggesting that we may not see any real meaningful rain, at least until January.
The message for Australians, be prepared.
People need to understand that if you live on or even near the bush, that there is an element of risk that comes with that.
Officials in New South Wales are advising people in fire-prone areas, just like in California, to have an escape plan.
Because you don't want to make the decision when the flames are now licking at your back door. That is too late. And that's when we know that lies a risk. But take responsibility for it. Don't think someone else is going to do it. Don't necessarily blame the fire agency or the government or whoever. You actually have a shared responsibility for fires, because California and New South Wales are some of the most bushfire-prone land in the world. So we all need to take a little bit of responsibility for that.
Inspector Shepherd takes a tough love approach, and he leaves it to Australians, known for their self-reliance and independence, to take care of themselves.
If you've done some preparation, you've got a well-prepared home, and well-prepared is not just having a hose. It's ensuring that you've trimmed back trees, mowed lawns, cleaned out your gutters, got adequate clothing to wear, but also that you're mentally and physically fit.
Then you're ready. That's Inspector Ben Shepherd of the Rural Fire Service, New South Wales, Australia. Here is a gross and frankly upsetting statistic. About one-third of the food produced for human consumption gets wasted. That is a lot of money and energy to grow food that nobody eats. That's not all. Most of us just toss our leftovers in the trash. That's extra bad for the environment, because when food rots in a landfill, it releases methane, a highly potent greenhouse gas. In Paris, a social enterprise thinks it can help to tackle this problem. The BBC's Dougal Shaw reports.
The sound of leftover French cuisine being put through the shredder. 2 tons of the stuff meets this fate here every day. I'm at a micro-industrial site for composting on the island of Saint-Denis, on the northern outskirts of Paris, an area designated as a space for green businesses 2 years ago by the government. The compost factory is run by a social enterprise called Les Alchemistes. Associate Director Cyrielle Callow explains to me their radical solution for the 900,000 tons of food waste Paris generates every year.
One of the biggest problems we noticed was that 30% of the waste produced within Paris was actually made of organic waste. This goes to landfill, which makes no sense. We decided we could take this organic matter, which is very precious, and turn it into a solution, to turn it into compost.
They collect this organic matter from restaurants they've signed up. Their machines shred this food, then the composting can begin.
So we are here in one of our composting sites.
What actually happens inside that silver composter that looks like a space rocket?
Yes, well, it's much, much simpler and low-tech than a spaceship. We basically mix the matter together in order for the air to go into organic waste. They allow to turn organic matter into compost within a few weeks instead of a few months.
The composter is a silver cylinder about the length of a minibus. It churns the food waste around, but also regulates temperature and oxygen supply. The technology has been imported from Macclesfield. It was invented by a father and son team in their back garden in the 1990s. They created a company that in the UK sells to places which provide catering, like hospitals, prisons or schools. And they also export composters everywhere from Chile to Hong Kong. There are currently two sites like this around Paris and four in the rest of France. They sell the compost in bulk to farmers and garden centres, and this funds the operation. At their site nearby in La Chapelle, it's time to find out how they fetch the food waste from restaurants. I'm meeting someone known as un collecteur, a collector, a cyclist employed to pedal around the city, pulling a trailer laden with buckets of food slops behind him. I catch up with Banzalil in his helmet and fluorescent jacket for a quick curbside chat.
Is it hard work?
Yeah, it's very hard. It's very hard.
There's a bit of a smell as well.
Yeah.
How many places do you visit in one day normally?
Oh, for one day I use sometimes 10 places to collect. More than 3 times I come back, go, come back.
One of his destinations is the Campanile Villette Hotel, where Cedri Darozo is an assistant manager.
Our generation, we are now really concerned about everything with the climate change and the waste of food. If we want to try to make something better to this situation in the future that we're concerned, we need to participate as we're trying to do here.
Sorting your organic waste is one of the easiest things you can do to help the planet.
French people care passionately about food, and this is also part of the food story.
Definitely. It's clearly, we call that the circular economy. It starts with the food, then you have organic waste, and then it goes back to land and to grow food. So it's clearly a big part of the French culture.
There is still some way to go before that circular economy is created, though. France is a patchwork of different approaches to food waste recycling, with some areas more keen than others. But new national rules that will come into effect in the next few years will make separate food waste collection far more widespread.
The BBC's Dougal Shaw reporting there from Paris. Here's another global environmental problem. Your shirt, your coffee, your car, good chance one of those came to you on board a cargo ship. It takes a lot of fuel to power those boats across the ocean and around the world. If the shipping industry were a country, its greenhouse gas emissions would rival Germany or Japan. But what if cargo ships could be powered by a clean, ancient technology? I'm talking sails here. That's a project that Diane Gilpin is working on. She's the CEO of Smart Green Shipping Alliance.
The cost of wind is entirely predictable. It is always free. And the shipping industry's operational cost, about 70% of it is fuel. So there is fuel saving and that's beneficial, but I think it's also really important to think about the predictability and certainty that wind can put into your business model.
So it would seem that sails might actually have a role to play here. A lot of people think this might be a crazy, novel idea. On the other hand, people have been using sails at sea for thousands of years. But can they really work on a cargo ship? What are some of the challenges and downsides that you need to address?
Yeah, initially it's got to work as a retrofit on an existing vessel, and that presents a significant number of design challenges. But ultimately, we are working towards 100% zero emission ship by 2030 with wind and zero emission fuel of some sort. We're favouring hydrogen at the moment. So, yeah, it's a lot of technical challenges, but as you say, 8,000 years of time-tested technology.
So a question a lot of manufacturers will want the answer to, will a cargo ship under sail be faster or slower than one running on conventional fossil fuels?
What wind can do, working in conjunction with an engine, whether it's fossil fuel or alternative fuel, is it can maintain the same speed but using less fuel, or it can go faster using the same amount of fuel as a conventional vessel.
So it sounds like win-win.
Yes, I think it's a win-win-win is how I think of it. It's a perfectly viable solution. We've just come out of a feasibility study working with a big importer of biomass from the US to the UK, and we're demonstrating fuel savings of 20% in the immediate future.
Diane, we're at a point where there might actually be more political willpower to make this change over to sails than ever. The International Maritime Organization, the UN agency that oversees shipping, has committed to reducing the emissions from the shipping industry by 50% by 2050. And one of the largest container shipping companies in the world, the Danish company Maersk, says it will be completely carbon neutral by 2050. Do you think those declarations are enough to make this all a reality? Is there really enough time to hit those goals?
The IMO's 50% by 2050 and Maersk's commitment, I think, are great and they're really helpful, but I think we need to get some closer targets, near-term targets. One of the challenges is that nobody wants to be a first mover. Everybody wants somebody else to go first so that they can absorb the first-of-kind costs and they can go through the higher risk stage. And until we start making targets a little bit closer to the time we are in now, so we need to see things for 2021, 2022, we're not going to see any great shift. So in 2020, what I would like to see is a rollout plan that says by 2023, we're going to reduce emissions by, say, 10% by 2025, something like that. So we can start to accelerate the process and not just sit on our hands and wait till 2048 and see what we can do.
And Diane, let me get this straight. You used to work in Formula One, which is all about guzzling fossil fuels, and now that you're the head of the Smart Green Shipping Alliance?
Yeah, well, I think it's really good learning. What I learned in Formula One was an enormous amount of technology development can go on the racetrack, and then that will be fed back into your road car. And the same is true for yacht racing and shipping. There's a lot of technology. You can see it in America's Cup. You can see it around the world races. So for me, it's like this race, the race to decarbonize shipping, is like Formula One on steroids. I mean, it's so real. It's so big. It's so challenging, but it feels doable.
Diane Gilpin, the CEO of Smart Green Shipping Alliance, thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
You ever get that sense when you're alone that someone's watching you? If you've ever stayed in one of Japan's henna robot hotels, the sensation would not be surprising that someone in your room is a harmless robot. It's there to turn the lights off, close the blinds, order room service, stuff like that. Sounds pretty good, but if somebody could hack that robot, well, suddenly it's not so harmless. Someone really could be watching you. Lance Vick kind of stumbled across this disturbing security vulnerability while staying at one of these hotels in Tokyo. Lance is a security researcher in Silicon Valley. Explain to us what you discovered about these robots when you stayed at this hotel chain.
Well, the robots in the check-in worked great, but when I got up to my room, there was this little adorable egg robot. And the fact that this device was in the room and not in a public space was a little bit concerning, so I wanted to see what it could do. And the presence of a camera on this device that's facing the bed in my hotel room was also a bit concerning.
Yeah, I think so.
yeah. It was like, hang on, let me think about this for a second. So as I'm exploring the device, I'm looking for buttons. My back of my hand actually hits the back of the unit, and I hear a boop. And this beep noise, and I realize it's from my ring, which is an NFC ring.
What's an NFC ring?
NFC, a near field communication ring. It's sort of a smart tag, if you will.
Okay.
There is a URL inside of this tag in my ring. So when I touch it to phones or other types of devices with these readers, it will launch a predefined URL or an application, etc. And in this case, it worked on this device. It actually, the eyes that were on the screen moved away, and instead a web browser pops up. Well, it had a link to settings right there. So I clicked that, which put me into settings. And sure enough, I could enable untrusted apps and install any app that I wanted. The implications of this are obviously quite concerning. Then I would be able to see through the camera of that device anytime that I wanted.
I mean, the short version of your story is that somebody who is smart enough like you could basically hack this robot and control it remotely. Am I getting that right?
There's a potential that somebody could just access the device directly without having to use this sort of a physical access. However, this physical access is simple enough that the entire setup virtually could be done on a single one of these tap cards. And so somebody who wanted to, who had access to rooms, maybe employee or anything like this, could just go and tap each of these bots and configure it in this way, full scale.
So, Lance, you later alerted the HIS group, which owns the hotel chain, about this vulnerability. What became of that?
The only response I ever got was after 90 days, after I decided, well, I got no response, I'm going to go ahead and make this public. They followed up after some journalism went around with a public statement saying that they had addressed the issue. I don't believe this is fully the case because I've only discussed one of the multiple issues that I found in public thus far, and they have yet to communicate with me to address the others. So I really don't believe they fixed all of the issues.
Should we be concerned by the concept of an entire hotel basically run by robots?
There are advantages, but I think that we have to think about the privacy implications of where these things are appropriate and where they're not. In a public space, these things can be very useful. But when it comes to private spaces, we have to be very sensitive to microphones and cameras and the security implications of these devices.
Yeah, and trust is going to be needed next summer in Japan during the 2020 Olympics, where robots are going to be playing a big role, including this hotel chain. What are Japanese authorities doing to secure these androids?
So far, I haven't seen evidence that they are really doing anything other than the one statement that they addressed the one public issue that I put out there. My hope is that since there was no response in publicizing these issues, it would kind of force them to have to address this or at least hire some security researchers who can help them. I guess we'll see how it plays out.
Lance Vick, a security researcher in Silicon Valley, speaking with us from Palo Alto, California. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Finally today, let's head off to Belize in Central America. It's a place where culture and identity have been shaped by a dynamic history, home to indigenous Maya, settled by slaves from Africa, colonized by the Spanish. So a little surprise that Bro David shakes things up musically. He invented his own style of funk, disco, and reggae in the 1980s and called it Congo. Bro David wanted Belize to have a sound that would compete with rhythms from Jamaica and here in the U.S. Here's Bro David taking us back to the mirror ball roots of Congo.
The whole music scene has woken up, and Congo music had a lot to do with that when I came with Congo music, you know, so I'm very proud of that. Dancing is one of those songs where whenever you hear it, you definitely got to move to the groove. Because it has a unique guitar riff in the beginning. We have our steady kick that we use in our cultural Caribbean music. And the bubble from the reggae, we speed it up a little bit. And the whole song just has that whole kind of Caribbean, Afro-centric mixture with some of the R&B, Afro-American music and rock music that we incorporate into the music. When you listen to the music, you will dance to the Congo music sound. One of the things that I notice all the time when we play the music, that we always get a very strong reaction. When we went to Europe, it was the same way. We went on about 3 o'clock and we came off about 4:30 and it was like rocking all the way. When we go into the Caribbean, it's the same way. When we go to the U.S., it's the same way. The music just have this infectious feeling that you get, this pulsating feeling that you get once you stand there and you listen to it and feel it. Introducing this type of music to the world makes me want to work harder. That's the reason why when when I found out about the reggae and the other songs, I said, well, we need to have our own music also. We had a music, we still have a music by the name of Brockdown, but people wasn't paying too much attention to it, right? And now we have Punta Rock, and then we have Paranda. So I think that's what helped to keep me driving on too, right? Because we have to keep pushing on.
I love the old stuff. Congo music there from Belizean musician Bro David. It's off his latest compilation, Modern Music from Belize. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. It's only Monday, everybody, so keep on pulsating.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.